I call this meeting of House Finance, the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:32 p.m. on Friday, March 17th, Happy St. Patrick's Day, 2023. Present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Klom, Representative Ortiz, Representative Kronk, Representative Tomaszewski, and Representative Foster. Assisting us today, we have our LYO moderator, Emma Turner, and Finance Secretary, Leah Frazier. Today, we will hear a presentation from the Department of Education and Early Development on school bond debt reimbursement and regional educational attendance area. Presenting will be Heidi Teschner, Acting Commissioner for Department of Education. And if you would like, Ms. Teschner, if you would like to come forward and introduce anyone that you would like to have assist you today, go ahead and come forward and put yourself on the record and introduce your fellow presenters.
Thank you, and good afternoon. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Acting Commissioner, Department of Education, Early Development. It's good to see you guys this afternoon. With me today, I have Joe Wilhoit. He's our facilities manager, and Ellen Bachmar, our school finance manager.
Welcome to House Finance.
I will get us started today and then pass off the presentation, but just to start, just a reminder of our mission, vision, and purpose. I know many of you are used to seeing this, but we're an excellent education for every day is our mission. Our statute, our vision comes right out of statutes, the state education policy, and we exist to provide information, resources, and leadership to support our mission of an excellent education for every student every day. And just as a reminder of our strategic priorities, our five Alaska Education Challenge strategic priorities, all of the work the department does is wrapped around these five priorities. The work of the facilities section, the presentation you're going to hear today, really kind of falls in priority number five, improving the safety and well-being of our students.
If you would just, I have a hard time hearing, and if you could just like slow down and maybe speak up, just for me, I would really appreciate that.
Yes, Madam Chair, I will do that. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I'll just restart this slide so everybody could hear me, and I'll slow down. Our five strategic priorities of Alaska's Education Challenge. This guides the work of the department and all the work that we do. And the work presentation you are going to get this afternoon really falls under priority number five, improving the safety and well-being of our students through our facilities that we have across the state. Slide number four is just a historic look at the capital school capital funding that is present in our schools. We have federal funding. There's state federal mechanisms. More general funds, we have our bonds. We've had general obligation bonds, also referred to as GO bonds, in 2003 and 2011, and then the AHFC, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, revenue bonds in 1999, 2001, and 2002. The debt reimbursement program, we'll get into this a little bit more further down in the presentation, but that started in 1971. And then our local educational agencies, these are LEAs, these are our school districts. They use their funding through their capital reserves to help fund their deferred maintenance needs on their facilities. And then those districts that the City Borough School Districts, about 34 of them that are not quite 34, but anyone who's with bonding authority have the municipal debt that they can also do. And I will pass the presentation. If there's no questions so far, I'll pass the presentation over to Mr. Wilhoit.
For the record, Joe Wilhoit, Facilities Manager for the Department of Education and Early Development. Our funding report, which is handout one, is SB 237. We do that annually. We put it out, it's out now, but we do it at the end of February every year by statute. Currently, the funding... I'm not going to read that number, but it's $1.5 billion. And that's total project value for debt projects and state grant projects. Okay, I'm going to move on. Okay, so there are essentially four funding options for facilities. The first three fall under my control, and the rest, the school debt reimbursement, are indirectly funded and will be covered more later in the presentation. The big three that I'm going to talk about primarily are the School Construction Grant Fund, the Major Maintenance Grant Fund, and the REAA and Small Municipal School Districts Fund. Of course, the REAA is an index fund, and it's the debt reimbursement divided by percentage to the municipal schools. It's directly tied to the debt reimbursement. I'm actually going to do these slides a little bit out of order here, just to make it make a little more sense. Did you have? Yes, ma'am.
Would you just, for anyone that's not fully aware of, you know, the differences? I know for years I didn't really know what the REAA was and what it stood for, and I'd come across it as a, you know, somewhere it said, oh, an election or whatever. I'd be, what is this, you know? Would you just like give a, not just a thumbnail, but, you know, a little bigger picture of what REAA is and just for the committee?
Absolutely. I think that it's the culmination of the efforts that were started with the Molly Hooch consent decree back in 1972, if I remember right, 1974. It applies to all school districts that are unorganized boroughs that are not able to fund projects through the municipal government. For example, bonding, unorganized districts cannot, unorganized boroughs cannot do bonding. So the only avenue they have to be able to get financing is or funding is through the REAA, which is set up specifically for those districts.
And I mean, I know one thing that gets said as far as city government or borough government is they would say, oh, well, those members that are in the unorganized borough, the state legislature, in essence, is their borough government, which I don't know exactly how to correlate that. But if you would talk about your unorganized borough and the school, how they have school district and funding sources and how the state legislature might interrelate with REAA areas differently than other boroughs.
I'm going to actually defer to Heidi, to Ellen for that question.
For the record, this is Ellen Blackwell, school finance manager. Over the years, I've done a little research on the REAAs. Prior to 1975, the unorganized areas of the state were under under what was referred to as an unorganized borough. The legislature had authority over that. It was referred to as a state-operated school system. So it was one large kind of school in that sense, and so it was administered in that way. In 1975, a bill was passed that authorized the department and the Department of Education and the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to coordinate the dividing up of that unorganized area into regional education attendance areas. Those were established, and I don't know exactly the first year that those districts went into operation. The rules behind that would be found in Alaska Statute 14.08, so that was what governed all of this. We had two more REAAs that were formed after 1985. They were old BIA schools that the BIA turned over to us, five communities. Of those five communities, three formed one REAA, and then a single community formed a second REAA, and the fifth community decided to become a part of the REAA, which they resided in. And so that is a brief overview of the formation of the regional educational attendance areas in the state of Alaska.
So one question on that, though. They have one school, even though they have different districts within, or different REAs, areas, there's one school board, the Alaska, I guess, State School Board. Is that, I might have the term wrong. Anyway, there's the one school board for that, for those areas. Isn't that correct?
Chair Johnson, the REAAs have their own school boards.
Okay.
So they are allowed, they have been partitioned out. They hold elections every few years to fill, every year or two to fill vacant board seats. Another little side note on this is every 10 years after the census data comes out, it's upon the department to work with DCCED to reapportion those seats based off of the board seats within the REAs based off of that census data. So they run their own boards. They even run their own advisory boards if they so choose.
I won't belabor this, but I just wanted to highlight that a little bit because it's, you know, a little different than most places, most things we're familiar with. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I want to just make sure, and my question is not about REAAs, but the report and data that you're presenting today that is due to the legislature every year, and you've given us the handout, SB 237, those are projects that we've already funded, right? That's a report on the retroactive. But I did notice that in some of those it says, you know, number of projects funded, and I'm guessing that that's not for the entirety of the lifespan, but in some fiscal window that we are currently in some debt obligation or funding of, but it does not include anything that is on the major maintenance list for asking for money. But just, am I correct?
Through the chair, for the record, Heidi Teschner, through the chair, Representative Hannon. So this report encompasses both what is included on a district CIP plan. So it's not all of this was funded by the legislature in a nutshell. So it encompasses both what has been funded. We capture what has been funded, but as well as what has been the ask for every year since this report was developed. For instance, if you look at the table on page 6 for, I'm just going to just say for fiscal year 2011 at the very top, the total eligible state share across 35 projects was $411 million.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. That brings us to a Xerox here. We do not appear to have, we have only odd numbered pages in the report.
Oh, no.
Okay. Brief it is. House Finance back on the record. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and carry on. I think we'll circle back with the answer to the question when we get the full handout back, to Representative Hannon's question. But I think it's the first handout, first section of the handout number one, that's not all there. So with what we can reference, I guess you can just continue on until we get our update.
Absolutely. Thanks, Chair. So I'm going to kind of re-review six just to kind of make sure that we're still on the same page here, because this relates to the next several slides. So again, the first three, the school construction, major maintenance, and REAA, are the three categories that fall into the CIP application. Moving on to slide seven, this is the first of several filters that we measure the CIP applications on. And it essentially breaks down school construction and major maintenance into the categories. It's the first filter. So there is the first one, A, relates to danger or imminent life-threatening situations. I'm not going to read all those. But A and B and F and G all relate to school construction. To put it in really basic terms, school construction and major maintenance, the difference between the two is, simply stated, is school construction is adding additional square footage. Major maintenance, it's a little bit confusing because it sounds like we're just doing maintenance, but it is projects that renovate or repair an existing structure. There's no increase in square footage typically. An example of that would be school construction, a new school or an addition to. Major maintenance is a roof repair. So the blue color is the major maintenance categories, and again, I won't necessarily read all those, but this is what differentiates the two basic categories in the CIP process. I will make an important note that major maintenance is not preventative maintenance, and that's where I talk about it being a potentially confusing term. But I think that's an important thing to note at this time. Moving on to slide eight.
Okay, let's go ahead and we'll go back and take care of our unfinished business now that we've gotten our handout in place. And I'll let Ms. Tishner answer Representative Hannon's question, then we'll carry on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So through the chair again to Representative Hannon. So on page six, there is table four. And just as an example for fiscal year 2011, there were 35 construction projects on that list for a total state share of $411 million. Only three projects got funded at a total of $128.5 million. So this shows you both what was asked versus what was actually appropriated by the legislature.
And all right, very good. Thank you.
One clarifying.
Please.
Some of the charts list school districts through the chair. And if they, so on page five, it has Alaska Gateway on chart three at the top, one project, zero approved. That's the year that they didn't get any funding for the one project they asked for. It's not that they've only ever asked for one and gotten nothing. It's not cumulative over the lifespan of the report, but some of the data in the report is cumulative.
Through the chair, Madam, or through the chair, Representative Hannon, this is a cumulative report. So it's going to show you for the life since from 2011 through 2023, the latest data that we have. This is how many projects have been funded, and specifically Table 3, how many projects each district has received and how much they've received in funding.
Okay.
Over that span of time.
One more.
I don't want to go on too long. Let's get to Representative Ortiz, and then we'll go ahead and finish this up.
Mine's real quick. So all of these fall under major maintenance, even though you're using the word maintenance, it's the same as major maintenance. These are all major maintenance projects?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. Table 3 is major maintenance.
Okay.
Yep.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So back on Table 3, there are 32 districts named. So that leads me to conclude the REAAs are not included in that list. So these are ones, and over the time span, Alaska Gateway has only ever asked for one project, and they've gotten $0 towards it.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So this is not all districts apply to the department to be on this capital improvement project list. So either the school construction or the major maintenance list. These are only for districts that have actually applied to be on the list and actually received funding. So Alaska Gateway, as an example, they did have one major maintenance project funded. There is an end note, and I need to get to that end note to...
Zero is what's throwing me off, if they were funded but the dollar value is zero.
Okay. Let's go ahead and continue on with our...
One quick answer to that. It was a reappropriated funding, so that's why it's showing as zero. There's an end note, and I had to find it. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to continue on. By the way, I am relatively new to the department. Representative Ortiz asked if I was the new Tim, and yes, I am the new Tim. I've been here since November, just to explain why Tim is not here and I am. So I'm going to move on to slide number 8. This is just a matrix that shows how the funding applies to the different project types and the different entity types. I'm not going to spend a tremendous amount of time on this slide. However, I will note that the CIP applications fall under the first two columns, and you can see that with all but one exception of the city and borough districts, the CIP applies to all of those categories and project types. If there's no questions on that, I'll move on to the next slide. Okay, this is the first filter split projects into major maintenance and capital improvement. This would be our next filter that we're going to discuss in this hearing. These are eligibility requirements that allow a project to be scored under the process. The actual CIP process has not begun at this point. It's another litmus test to make sure that they're eligible and they have everything ready for us to be able to review. The first one is the six-year capital improvement plan. That's the district's six-year plan. The second one is an enrollment in the enrollment of all fixed assets. The third one is proof of insurance, and some of these might be relatively obvious why we would need those, but we need them to provide proof of insurance as part of that. I'm going to get down to the preventative maintenance section again. Again, as I mentioned before, major maintenance is not preventive maintenance. It's not funded by our department or deed. It's funded. Preventive maintenance is funded by the district. So one of the requirements that we have to ensure that they're maintaining their building and they just don't depend on us for major maintenance funds is the preventive maintenance requirement in our eligibility. Sorry, I thought you raised your hand. We have a five-year cycle where Wayne Marquis, one of the members of my team, goes around on a five-year cycle to try to visit as many districts as we possibly can to view how they are progressing. If a district or a school is not performing well, we put them on a provisional list, which still allows them to present their CIP application under the hope that they are able to come off that provisional list. If they do not, in a certain amount of time, come off that, then they are not eligible for any of the grants that we offer. The fifth one, Actually, I'm going to move down to number six. The sixth one is participating share. We have a matrix that shows how much essentially skin in the game that the district is able to offer to offset the cost of the grant. Okay, moving on to slide number 10. Some of this is redundant, but I am going to go through 1, 2, and 4. The application, this is essentially just kind of explaining how that it all falls together. The capital improvement project application is due at the 1st of September. We review those after we've gone through the first couple of filters to find out which application or which whether they make it into the CIP process. We do a project ranking, which is a as objective a process as we can possibly make to rank the projects, and which is what eventually ends up in the SB 237. It goes through the BRGR, is approved by them, is eventually approved by the state board to send on to the legislature, and that should be coming soon. I'm not going to cover eligibility again because I think we've already talked about that. The CIP priority list is what I was referring to, which is released on November 5th and is, again, blessed by or approved by not only the BRGR, but also the state board, and then sent out with a list of priority based on the CIP ranking. There are 9 different divisions in the CIP ranking. I think there's 54 different questions that they have to provide answers to, and the more, and it's a list based on entirely on need, reviewed by 3 different rankers, and then we go through and consolidate to generate the list.
All right, we're going to take a stop there, and we have a question from Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, I did have one question with going back a slide to slide 9. You mentioned that it's part of their eligibility. They would need to have certified preventative maintenance program, I assume, like in place so that you know that they'll be able to take care of whatever the building. I'm wondering how that looks for our EAA districts or districts who don't have a tax base. How do we support that then by coming up with both the insurance and also a plan and make sure that we can help them with that maintenance?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, no, it is it's incumbent upon each district to provide funds for maintenance. The offset of that is the smaller districts usually have smaller schools, mm-hmm. so there's less cost involved in maintenance. But they do have to document their maintenance plan, their maintenance procedures, and show historic examples of what they've completed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. We have Representative Ortiz, followed by Representative Colom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. Are we going to be going back in this presentation? Are we going to be going to, in essence, what is handout 6 or the major maintenance grant fund, or have we already discussed that and this is just for added information? Because if we do, I have a question about this, but if we're going to address this later, then I can ask my question later.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we were going to address that later.
Okay, great. Yeah. Move on, please. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Very good. We have Representative Colom.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So a couple of short questions, if I may, Chair. First of all, what's BRGR?
Through the chair, Representative Colom, the BRGR is the Bond Reimbursement and Grant Review Committee. Okay.
Also, you mentioned that there was 9 divisions in the CIP. Are those 9? So those 9 divisions is what helps you prioritize the projects? Is that what you were saying?
It is through the chair, Representative Colom. Mm-hmm. It is the our standard format for the CIP application. Mm-hmm. It is what we go through just to make sure everything is apples to apples. Every applicant has to use our format because it answers a certain amount of important questions. Like, for example, their preventive maintenance is one of the categories in there. But, yes, that's what we take, and it allows us to make as objective a process as we possibly can because we're measuring them all based on the same template.
Okay, and one more follow-up? Follow-up. Through the chair. So what can you explain what appeal for reconsideration looks like for a school? And why would I assume the appeal for reconsideration is that they failed to meet the benchmarks, and it sounds like they have some kind of process to try to get back in. Is that what an appeal for reconsideration means?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne. Yes, so the reconsideration hearings are a formal way for the districts that are the schools that put forward the districts that put forward the applications for them to contest a score. Or have us reconsider something that was potentially missed or misunderstood. We usually have some of those every year where we go through. We make a recommendation to the commissioner of whether we accept or don't the reconsideration. Often I think we do our best to be as fair as we can with each one of those applications. Or reconsiderations. If we aren't able to come to a amicable solution, they still have the appeals process. The appeals process is much more formal and litigious, and it's primarily handled through law, through legal.
Oh, wow.
To the best of my knowledge, we did have a request for an appeal this year. Through our legal, we were able to again, go back and have a second, I'm going to say a reappeal, and we were able to come to an agreement before we took it to a legal proceeding. However, I think that was the first one that we had had in 10 years at least. Usually the system is fair enough that we've only had one close call in the last 10 years.
Okay, thank you.
Next up, I believe we have Representative...
And was BRGR.
Yeah. Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question. This really struck something. How much does it cost every district to apply for this? Because if I remember something right, it's very costly. And sometimes the districts, it's just so much money, they're not willing to continue to do that.
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, that is an excellent question, and it's one that has gotten brought up several times. It's a point of concern. However, there is no application fee for the application itself. The things that we do require, like schematic construction drawings, cost estimates, those do cost the districts a certain amount of money. I can say with complete certainty after years in practice that these are things that the districts would most have to pay for anyway just to move forward. Like you need to have reasonable construction drawings to be able to build the project. You need to have an established budget. These are things that they would have to do anyway. We just require them up front to be able to have enough information to judge the project. Okay. I think we've gone through this slide, so I'm going to move on to slide 11. This is for the last 14 years since we've had REAA school districts. I think this shows a breakdown of the grant applicants, the applications per year. Now, I do want to make an important note that this is not the approved projects. This is just the number that came through. And you can see by the color coding that the vast majority are major maintenance projects, followed by school construction and the relatively small ineligible projects. This is something that we're working really hard as a facilities team every year to put on a workshop to make sure that everybody is well educated on the CIP process, the application process. So our goal is to have no ineligible projects or applications submitted, but there are always a few that fall between the cracks. But we're shooting for zero. On the other hand, this is the a slide that shows from 2014 to current the actual grant awards, broken down by, again, school construction, major maintenance, and REAA. And I'm not going to go through each individual number, but if you have questions on this slide.
Yes. I actually have this broken down, and I was going to wait until we got to the next page, like every three pages, but this one does have a lot of, okay, well, this one has a lot of information on it, so go ahead. Representative Galvin.
I just have a very quick question to kind of go back to Representative Cronk's notion. On the ineligibility that on slide 11, I wondered if you would help us know, in general, why they are ineligible. Is it usually because they're not meeting the standard of drawings or something that may cost quite a bit? Or, you know, I know sometimes to get cost estimates and particularly to get architectural work done, it may be a cost factor. And I was just curious to know if that tends to be the reason that you have. I see over the last few years, not too many, but quite a few back in 19 pre-pandemic times. So wondered if you would help just give us a sense of why they're rejected or ineligible.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, for the record, Heidi Teschner. So as, because I just looked at research just the other day, actually. Yeah. So just of the four projects, a couple of these, and for fiscal year 24, a couple of these projects, it was because they, the district didn't include, they submitted an application, but that application wasn't identified on their six-year plan. And so because there's no accrual, they didn't identify it there. That's one example. Another example might be that they didn't follow the proper procurement requirements for a construction project. So that would make them ineligible. Those are just a couple examples.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So no common theme related to not enough money to get it done.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay. We move on to slide 13. This is again a breakdown of grant and actual grant funding by fiscal year. It's essentially a further deep dive into the two previous slides. You can see the number of projects that were put forward, and the number of projects in the third column that were funded, and then the amount funded on that slide.
Representative Ortiz.
Under FY23, under maintenance, it says that there were 21 number of projects funded. But didn't the legislature appropriate all of the list, but then the governor, so to say they weren't funded after the governor's vetoes, is that correct? In other words, I believe that we put forward last year the full list, I think, and then that didn't happen. It's obvious that that didn't happen. Am I correct that it was because of a veto?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the legislature didn't fund the whole list. There were vetoes over the last few years. In 2022, there was, on the next slide when we get to it, we'll just move to slide 14. There was the fiscal year 22 plus supplemental, so $101 million that was appropriated. That was, this particular slide is the REA fund. But so there was a combination of the funding that got, the additional supplemental funding that was put in was for the REA fund, and then there was some major maintenance funding as well, which helped fund the $47 million in fiscal year 2023. That's on slide 13.
Follow up.
So
what you're saying is we didn't appropriate the full list last year for FY23 for this current year?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, no, we did not. The full funding wasn't the final appropriation and the final budget didn't fund the full list.
Okay, I'll check on that. Thank you.
Very good.
Okay. For the record, Joe Wilhoit. Moving on to slide 14, I think we've more or less covered this, but it just shows the appropriation for appropriation amount for each year since 2013. I'm not necessarily going to go through the entire list here, but this is the allocations from the REAA and Small Municipal District Fund. Unlike the previous major maintenance, this one shows the allocations per project for the REAA. I will. There's one other thing that I should have said when we talked about the first filter. I want this to be clear and understood. When we divide the projects between school construction and major maintenance, one of the categories, the first one, A, is deciding whether it's a disaster or an emergency project. That filter does not necessarily rank the project. It does show that it is important and it potentially needs to be kick it into a school construction project if there's been a disaster, but at that point that filter does not fall into the CIP ranking at the application review. We have an entirely different section in one of the nine divisions of the application speaks directly to emergency projects. That's when they get their emergency allocation of points. Which, of course, pushes them to the top of the list. So that's been a point of concern and confusion in the past. Although it is a filter to get it into the system, it's not part of the system. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Blackwell.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, just on that last point, emergencies and the like. So I taught in an REA school system until 1994. Before I went to graduate school a second time. And the next year, 1995, a fire destroyed the main high school in the village. That would have been something that would have moved, that would have had special treatment and would have moved to the top of the list.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson? Sorry. That is correct. Yes, and we've got a few projects that are on the list, that have been on the list the last couple of years.
For the record, this is Owen Blackwell. In your particular scenario, they would have to have had replacement cost insurance, and so the insurance would cover the loss of the structure in that case. The only time I can imagine where this project would end up on the list as if for some reason there was a shortness in funding or the insurance proceeds. But in the years that we've had schools burned down in rural Alaska, the insurance has covered the reconstruction of those buildings. You know, if you had a roof failure and perhaps a collapse, you know, you might see some funding if the insurance was short. But in many of these cases, insurance will cover most of the cost of that.
Thank you for that correction. Yes, that's one of the reasons why we have the filter of eligibility for the insurance.
Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and I was fortunate enough to go work on two schools in 2019. One was in St. Mary's, and one was in Nunumaquaw, and the St. Mary's ones concerns me because they had an old Quonset hut was over a bus barn, and I'm not sure what title it was. It was renovation, but we literally had to tear it down and use any part of the existing structure to rebuild it at twice the cost if we had just built the new building. That seems like an absolute – something needs to change there. I mean, because we could have built a brand new building for half of the cost of us using the old ribs of an old Quonset hut and making it work. So and then what's the responsibility of an engineer or contractor? In Nunumaquaw, we hauled in millions of yards of gravel and actually poured a cement pad and built a school, filled in a lake basically, and built a school on top of that. and we were cutting out cement hallways to access the sewer pipes because of the sewer sink. Somebody must be responsible for that, because that nowhere else out there is there not a school that's on pilings. And so I see the 2023, which doesn't surprise me, foundation cooling repairs, because they're going to have to put cooling units under to refreeze the ground to keep that school from sinking further. So is there any responsibility on an engineer per se that designed that specific thing there? That I think anybody could tell you that a cement pad on top of a lake probably wasn't going to work.
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, to your first question, yes, there should be a value analysis on whether a project is, and I do believe, well, we want to skip to that. Should we have an answer? I'll have to get back to you on that one. I'm going to use the new, I'm new card on that one. As far as liability and responsibility, I'm not sure I should necessarily speak to that on the record. However, I'd be more than happy to talk to you offline to respond to that question.
Thank you.
One second. So what I think I would like to do is we're on page 16, page 15, page 16. Let's go ahead and go through page 21 and talk about the debt. I know that's kind of the main thing that you're here to talk about, is this way that you go through the debt reimbursement eligibility and the trends and so on. So let's go ahead and make sure we just do that uninterrupted. And then when we get to the end, maybe we'll have a chance to, we can ask, go through the questions on debt reimbursement and so on. And then I know that there's some projects that are near and dear to people's hearts that might give us a chance to then, we can talk about some of the funding sources, some of the different projects and so on at the end. So let's go ahead and go through the debt reimbursement portion, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the various projects and some of the additional things that you can add to that.
For the record, this is Elwin Blackwell, School Finance Manager. I'll be going through the sections dealing with debt reimbursement. This particular slide, we're just going over the establishment of the debt reimbursement program. It resides in 1411-100. Capital improvement project application, we use the exact same application that the CIP uses. And so we use the same application that the CIP project uses. They just check a box as debt and not capital improvement, part of the grant program. From there, there is no priority list associated with debt, because if you can issue debt and the project is eligible, it can be approved, and you can go issue your debt when the program is open. I'll qualify it with that. To number three, that's what I was referring to. There is no project ranking because of the nature of the municipalities issuing the debt. Eligibility, basically, all types of cities except third class and all types of boroughs. So any municipality out there that has bonding authority can participate in the program. In 4C, they are subject to the same eligibility requirements. They have to have a six-year plan, fixed asset, inventory system. They still have to have insurance, and they still have to have a functioning preventative maintenance program that's been certified by the department. This slide is just kind of giving us a breakdown of the reimbursement percentages over time. When the program came to Department of Education back in 1971, it was at 100%. Over the years, it's been changed to 90, then to 80%, then to 70%. Of note is in 2000, the legislature provided an opportunity for school districts or municipalities that are school districts that wanted to add space to their buildings that didn't qualify for that space to be able to still participate in the debt reimbursement program, but the state would only participate at 60% as opposed to 70. So that's the difference between 70 and 60%. It has to do with whether or not you qualify for the added space or not. That's the big driver. But With that being said, in 2015, under SBA 64, a moratorium was put on the debt program for 5 years. It was meant to be expired in fiscal year 2020, but in the 2020 legislature, House Bill 106 was passed, which extended that moratorium until fiscal year 2025. Currently, the way the statute is written, when the program comes back online in fiscal year 2026, the reimbursement rates would be at 50% and 40%, similar breakout for 70 and 60. So 50% if you qualify for space and major maintenance, 40% if you don't qualify for the space. The state would only participate at 40%. We do have a footnote down here at the bottom. We have had a few instances where the percentage in one case was 90% for a particular borough. And that's the only time that it broke this trend. On this, we are giving you project values by a percent of the reimbursement. So this is taking a look at the project values by the 90%, 80%, 70, and 60. This is taking a look back a few years, not back to the beginning of time. This particular chart here that we are showing you, and this will correlate to handout number two, is the state share of outstanding debt. So in this graph, the yellow represents principal, the blue represents the interest on that principal, and the line running through them all is the state, would be the state's portion, of the reimbursement. This particular graph is taking a look at it from a funding standpoint. So we have handouts number three and number four, which displays this data in a different way. These, since 1976, we've had some years of full funding, a lot of years of full funding. There have been a few years where the program was underfunded and was prorated. One note I will make is in fiscal year 2017, 2020, 21, and 22 to begin with, those were all underfunded. But with that appropriation that was made in last year, 2022, the municipalities were reimbursed up to 100% of what they should have received in those years. So you will see that this line shows that they didn't receive 100% in those years. That was what actually happened. But in reality, they've been caught up at this point. So in 2017, 2020, 2021, 2022, that $101 million, I believe is pretty close to what it was, caught these municipalities up on what they had been underfunded in those years. We do not have any sort of projection of what is going to be paid for 23 and 24. We've left these numbers at the projected amounts and what's in the governor's budget. If we come back next year, we will have a line hooking those up to what actually happened at this point. We anticipate full reimbursement, but at this point, we have left that line off of there. This slide is just going over two different types of bonds that we will see in the program. We have initial bond sales. This is going to be bonds that are sold. So typically the process is the municipality or school district will send us an application for a project. Once it's been reviewed and we're both agreed upon the cost of that project, the municipality then will go to their voters, get voter approval. Once they have voter approval, they will then go out and issue these bonds. So an initial bond sale would represent the initial offering to fund a portion or all of the project. Many municipalities will split the project cost up over multiple bonds, so we track that. If for some reason if the municipality decides to throw other types of projects into that bond issuance, we will isolate out the school piece of it and prorate the bond, what we'll reimburse on the bond. Do you want me to continue?
Are we finished with this slide?
Not yet.
Not quite. Okay, let's finish up the slide, and then we'll take some questions.
Thank you. There are instances after the initial bond issue, we get several years down the road, and the municipality can reissue or can issue a new bond to pay off portions of that older bond so they can save on the interest rate. So every year of that initial bond may have a different interest rate associated with it. And so they get into the out years and they find that they can reduce their financing cost if they issue a new bond to pay it off. Those would be refunding bonds. There's a section within the statute that provides for what they need to do. Largely, they have to show an annual savings. Between the refunding and the initial bond, there has to be an annual savings associated with it. And that's largely the only criteria they have to show. So we do analyze those to make sure that all the out years will have an annual savings. I believe we are now done with this slide.
We have a question from Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. My question is about federal ARPA money. I'm not sure if anything, I know that many districts through the pandemic were given dollars. I think the state was passed through and they were able to use it for some construction work. I didn't know if they were able to use it on any reimbursement of anything. And I just thought I would ask if there were any that were used through either major maintenance for health and safety and such or not.
For the record, Heidi Teschner, through the chair, Representative Galvin. Yes, there were some districts that did use it for construction projects supporting that. Unfortunately, I don't have that data in front of me, but I'm happy to provide a report back to the committee with which districts used it and what they used it for related to construction and major maintenance.
Thank you. One quick follow-up. If you could also, I'm not sure if this was even allowed or permissible, but if any was used to backfill some of the work that they had done in previously, even in 19 and 20, if they had been able to backfill those dollars with that work, if that was allowed.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, it was really to address pandemic needs. So if there was like a need to increase, address HVAC systems and things like that, it was for the immediate needs. So nothing backdated, anything current.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. My question starts on page 17, or slide 17. The reimbursement rates to district. Now, I've only been in office, this is my fifth year, first year on finance, but what I've always understood, and understanding that we didn't always fund that, but that the school bond debt reimbursement share was 50%. But that doesn't really match this chart. But we've got a gap from FY 2015. Then we talk about the moratoriums, and it says starting in 26, it's 50%. So in 19, 20, 21, and 22 was the school bond debt reimbursement share owed to district that had prior debt. Was it 70%? Should have been in those years? Or is it already at 50%?
For the record, Elwin Blackwell, through the chair, Representative Hannon. So, yes, if the bonds were approved by the voters and issued, and really the key here is whether the bonds were authorized by the voters before the moratorium happened, then those bonds, as they were sold, would be reimbursed at either 70% or 60%, depending on whether they qualified for space or not. That reimbursement percentage will remain the same until the bond is paid off. Currently, the program is closed. So any new voter-approved bonds are not, we won't be able to approve any projects right now. Once the program opens and voters approve, the new reimbursement rates for anything after FY 2026 would receive reimbursements of 50 and 40.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just confused, having not been on finance, what was always described to me, and through redistricting, I now only have one school district, but before I had three school districts that had debt, and what was always stuck with me was that And of course, these were prior to the moratorium. They were already approved, but that they were 50%. And so I was just confused by that. So I may have picked that figure up and not understood that they were getting more than that. Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, I guess to Mr. Blackwell, I would imagine, or anyone else at the table, I suppose. So my question, you know, earlier in the presentation, we kind of talked about the commercial risk insurance for a lot of these buildings and replacement costs, but my thoughts turn to the kind of catastrophic loss of Pocatovic School in 2020, and I'm curious, I want to say that the revocal amount from the insurance claim was around $20 million, and that's not really that close to the replacement value. So I'm curious if you could speak to that, and is that a common practice in rural schools when it comes to commercial risk insurance?
And I'm going to just jump in there because I want to dig into that and talk about some projects, certainly, but let's go ahead and finish up the we just got a couple more pages here, and then we can talk about some projects
and
some of your handouts.
Again, for the record, Heidi Teschner. So slide 22 is just really a takeaway slide for the committee. One thing I do want to point out is that, because we mentioned it, but just so the committee is aware and the public is aware, the participating share amounts, all RAAs have a 2% participating share in the municipalities. So the range for REA and small municipal school districts, that range, REA school districts, the 19 districts that we have, 2% participating share. The small municipalities are between 10 and 20%. And then under school construction and major maintenance grants, that participating share ranges from 2% to 35%. I just wanted to make that the committee aware about. Again, a takeaway slide of what we presented to you today. And then slide 23. We're just additional handouts for you in your packet. This is our chance we can discuss any of the projects on the school construction or major maintenance list. Our facilities website has a wealth of information, and these are links for the committee and the public to go view the information that we have out there. And that is our presentation this afternoon. We just welcome any other questions.
All right, very good. Since I had asked, since I had called upon Representative Staff and then kind of asking to wait a few minutes, I'm going to go back to Representative Staff and I have, go ahead.
Yeah, through the Chair to the folks, I can ask the question again if you'd like.
Yes. Through the Chair, Representative Staff, I think I understand the question well enough to at least take a first pass at it, and then I can call a lifeline if I need to. One of the requirements that we have as a requirement to get into the second filter to get into the CIP process is insurance. Although we do require it, we don't necessarily get into the business of the district to analyze and scrutinize their insurance policy. We feel like that's incumbent upon them to do. I think we're learning that sometimes they don't always insure the full value as they're supposed to. But again, that's not something that we delve into too deeply.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So through the Chair to the members of the committee. So I think I would agree with you normally, but considering the state's effectively on the hook for the cost replacement due to the program of school bond debt reimbursement, we probably have a vested interest, I would imagine, to ensure that our local school districts are effectively. I mean, if insurance is going to be a requirement, I mean, wouldn't it make sense that you would ensure that the actual replacement coverage is at an adequate level amount in the event you have a catastrophic loss?
Through the Chair, Representative Staff, yes, I completely agree. We should. And we can make that change within the department and make sure that we're doing a better job of looking at the insurance values when we get that documentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Colom.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair. So along kind of, I guess this is kind of is connected to with what Representative Staff was talking about. I guess this would be to Ms. Teschner. So on slide 16, on C, So districts must have a six-year plan, a fixed asset inventory, adequate property loss insurance, preventative maintenance and facility management program certified by the department. So that seems like a tall order for some of these rural districts. I guess my question is that applied to the REAA projects? And also, does DEED have any resources for districts to make all that happen if they need the help?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb. So on slide 16, this is just on the debt program. So REAs are they don't have the bonding authority, so they don't qualify for the debt program.
Okay.
But when you go back to the CIP, the school construction major maintenance, smaller districts who don't have the staffing to do this, the Southeast Regional Resource Center, CERC, provides, they have a facilities manager, I don't know if they have more than one, but they at least have one facilities manager that helps the smaller rural school districts develop their applications, goes out to those sites and really helps them with this because they can't hire somebody to go out there. So they provide that service for our smaller districts.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Plum.
Through the chair, I guess it's not really, it's kind of a separate question, kind of a simple one, probably to Mr. Blackwell. Mr. Blackwell, on page 20, when you were talking about debt reimbursement trends, you used the word underfunded a lot. What does underfunded mean?
For the record, Elwin Blackwell, through the chair, Representative Colomb, underfunded means that it was not funded at 100% of the reimbursement amount for that year. So in other words, if we had put forth a budget amount of $100 million, it was only, the appropriation was only $90 million, so we would have had to have prorated those programs. There have been a few years back in the 80s and 90s, there were some years where the program was underfunded. For many years, many decades after that, the program was funded at 100%. And then it's only been in the last 7 or 8 years that we've started to see the program experience years where they were not fully funded. But with the catch-up, I think we can kind of gloss over that and say that they have been fully funded for multiple decades now to the work of the legislature in trying to catch them up.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Cronk. I'm sorry, Representative Ortiz might have been on the list. And then Representative Cronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. Yeah. Anyway, going back to, well, first of all of these different areas that we're talking about funding, this comes through the capital budget. Is that where it comes through in all of these different cases? For school construction, major maintenance, all the different things, they come through the capital budget? That's a question.
That's a question. Yes, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So school construction, major maintenance, and the REA fund all come through. Those are basically capital projects. The debt program is funded through the operating fund.
Okay.
And actually, let me clarify what I just said. So, yes, the debt comes through the operating fund. The REA fund is capitalized through the operating fund. There's a language item, and it's capital. It's like a transfer from the general fund into the REA, Small Municipal School District Fund, and that's in the capital and the operating budget.
Okay. So can you remind me what is the current proposed funding level for, let's say, major maintenance grant fund in the current budget that's before us, in the governor's budget for major maintenance? What's there? Can you tell me?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the only funding towards major maintenance and school construction is through the REA fund, and it's about $32 million. There's no direct funding appropriation in the budget for major maintenance or school construction.
Last follow-up. So just for clarification then, and mainly for the listening public, we have this list that says major maintenance grant fund. And does this list include both REAAs and borough school districts, both?
Through the chair, that is correct, both.
Okay. So the only thing that's going to be addressed under the current budget is those REA schools that are on the list and up to that amount of money that you mentioned, but none of these projects will be addressed under the current budget this year. So they continue on as being major maintenance that needs to be addressed. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes. So anything that does not get funded, based on whatever the final budget ends up being, anything that doesn't get funded, districts would reapply for if they want to next year, but it basically goes unfunded. This is still outstanding need at the district level. And just to clarify what I said, the 24 proposed transfer into the REA fund is about $28 million. It was $32 million in fiscal year 23. So in 24, it's going to be about $28
million. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Next up, we have Representative, I believe I missed Representative Josephson, so just so you know that after Representative Cronk, you are on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's go back to what Representative Stapp was asking about, Coctovic School. Can you give us an update of where it's at, what's been done, how much money they have, and how much money might be needed to complete that? Is that possible?
I'm calling a lifeline.
For the record, Lori Weed, School Finance Specialist with School Facilities.
Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Cronk, I did recently follow up based on the other body's question regarding Coctovic. They have currently been receiving insurance proceeds, but I have not inquired about the amount. It was more to the what has currently been accomplished. So they are they have used their insurance proceeds to provide temporary school facilities for their students so that they are housed for their educational program. And then they are still continuing design of more permanent facilities, starting with, I believe, a gymnasium or career tech center type facility in order to meet those educational needs. But that's all the information I have at this time.
Thank you. Go ahead. I have some other questions.
So if I could follow up on that. So all I know is what I've kind of read in the newspaper, not anything specific here, but my understanding is they used the monies from the insurance because it had burned down their new gymnasium, but they had their old part of the school that caught on fire and then actually burned down the new part of their school as well. And then, but they used their insurance monies to get the classrooms rebuilt or get their interim school. But they don't have any kind of gymnasium facilities or anything like they used to have. So they aren't made whole, but they've used their insurance and I don't know what all ever else. So would that count towards getting into the, you know, the grant funding, or should they have, or, you know, it seems like there's a hole in get their funding. What would your suggestions that they should next look at? I mean, I think obviously legislative funding might also be an option, but I wanted to explore these options as well.
Madam Chair, as has been previously said, hopefully that we would hope that the insured value and the replacement costs and the negotiations that they are working for with the insurer would provide them with a whole and complete building. Our set of buildings, we would have to evaluate if it came before our grant program whether they had been involved enough in their insurance process to then have supplementary potential funding for things that would not have otherwise been covered under insurance. With it being a borough and not an REAA with a state-owned facility, we are, you know, two steps removed from the insurance negotiation processes, so we are not involved.
I see. I just want to make note for anyone that's seen some Bush schools and some of the conditions. I suspect that if you were going to rebuild, it's hard to find a 1945 era Quonset hut to put back up. So it probably could have cost a little bit more sometimes. All right. I believe did you have a follow-up, Representative Cronk? Yeah, okay, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, to the panel here. So on the major maintenance list, number 29, Service High School reports that it has health and safety improvement needs. It's seeking $5.46 million. And that means DEED has already said, yeah, we reviewed your documents. We checked the boxes. It looks legit. Is that what that Is that what that means?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Follow
up? Follow up.
And so the capital budget last year, and Representative Ortiz talked about this, we funded just over $100 million. The governor let us have $30 or $40 million. But basically no urban schools in the current capital budget are being given any major maintenance grant funds. Is that mostly correct?
Through the chair, it is correct that there is no major maintenance funding identified in the capital budget.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
I noticed something that caught my eye. It was on page 22. On the left side, it says REAA's participating share 2%. What is that? Can someone describe 2%? First of all, what is the remind me what REA/small munis? I know what that means. It's the 17 plus the 3 or whatever. But apparently there's a requirement they pony up 2% of something. What is it we're talking about here?
Through the chair, the 2% is we approve the department as it reviews the CIP application. We approve a recommended project value. And so the 2% is 2% of that approved project value, and then the state share being the other 98%.
Follow up? I apologize. Does the 2% mean that, for example, in my former employer's district, the Cuspuck School District, which was Kalskag, Aniak, Red Devil, Sleep Mute, et cetera, that the folks that live in that area need to contribute 2% of the cost?
Through the chair, the funding comes from the capital reserves of the school district, so it is primarily funded through their foundation formula, and then.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Stapp.
thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the wonderful folks at Deeds. So I'm curious, with the concept of school bond debt reimbursement being most of, the 2000s, I'd say 70% reimbursement rate. When I think about that in relation to the foundation formula school size multiplier, I am curious if we have a basically concept where we are trying to effectively bond facilities that are effectively larger square footage with less people. Has anyone ever wondered if we have effectively, probably unintentionally, incentivized that type of construction and buildings? I'm just curious.
For the record, this is Owen Blackwell, through the chair, Representative Staff. If a district is willing, or if a municipality is willing to take a lower participation from the state, they would be able to build a building larger than what we would say they qualify for the number of students they have. So we do have some size require, student population is relative to the size of your school. And so if they wanted to add a little bit more square footage to their building for some reason, but they didn't qualify for it, in other words, they didn't have within the department, it would be referred to as unhoused students. They had no unhoused students per the calculations. Then the debt reimbursement program would let them participate, but they would participate at a lower reimbursement level. So, yes, there is the potential to incentivize a district, if they're willing to take less, to build bigger buildings than they really need for their student population.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, in reading the handout number 6 and in knowing that we have currently nothing on the books to support these projects, I just would like to call out a couple of them that are of concern. In fact, of course, they all are, because I know you worked through your criteria to make sure that these are projects that are providing health and safety and meeting your mission as a Department of Education, and of course, and our Constitution, Article 7, public education. We know that we have an obligation. The legislature shall by law establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children in the state. And I'm just seeing in here mostly the roofs, right? That, and I know that in my district there's a lot of classrooms with some buckets. I get that. Yes, it may lead to some illness and things like that, which is not good. But I'm also seeing other things like Bethel campus fire pump house and fire protection upgrades. One in my school, in my district, talked about a fire alarm that has to get come in place. I see asbestos removal, which is very expensive and very important for health and safety. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to call to our attention, all of us, that I'm worried about this, especially given the lawsuits that happened with the Molly Hooch case, for example, and Representative Stapp brought up an important case in rural Alaska where we were not, it looks like we didn't have the right amount of insurance. We have some work to do, I think, to not only make sure we are properly insured in the future, but we've got some catch-up to do. And we've been learning about this in other places, many other departments that have to have some upgrades, even the university system, other places. But this feels very critical because it is our responsibility. And so I hope that we'll continue to work together and that the governor will also work with us, because this looks very, very important. And I appreciate this extended presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. My first one's real simple, then I've got one that isn't on the paper. But just to understand the major maintenance list, let's just say we put $80 million into major maintenance, that would mean we would fund projects 1 through 41, right? That just, it goes down the list and funds the projects on there. Okay. Then my second question through the chair is, we've heard about Pactovic, but my recollection in the last year or two, we've seen several schools burn. Can you tell me how many schools we have that would be deemed emergencies that need total replacement or significant replacement, either to fire, flood, collapse, that we've got currently?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's a difficult question to answer. The way you asked it, yes, we have several projects that there are several facilities that have burned, at least two in the last 6 months or year. Two that are subsiding to beach erosion. And several others that are imminent throughout the western part of the state. But to the previous point that Representative Galvin made, a lot of these schools are in danger. When a child has to sit in a cold classroom with a coat on, I would consider that also in danger.
One follow-up, Chair Johnson?
Yeah, follow up.
So I want to separate the ones that we think might be on the maintenance list for that, but two to fire that we've totally lost, and one to a, and I guess I'm not even talking about ones that we know are on the verge of sloughing off, but we've got some, we got two or three that burned. I thought one collapsed. Can you name the, I mean, we've got some that are total voids. I mean, if the school is gone, that's a more serious emergency in my mind than we've got leaky facilities.
What is your question?
How many schools do we have that are in emergency crisis that we lost to fire or flood or collapse in the last 1 or 2 years?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, I'm going to follow up with you on that question, and we'll give you a list of not only the schools that are unoccupiable because of damage, but the ones that are imminent to be that.
Unoccupiable was the term I should have been using. I just hadn't heard. Okay. So.
All right. Thank you. Representative Cronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Big general question.
as a former teacher of the, I'm talking rural Alaska, has anyone in the department proposed to have whatever size, you know, we can divide it up, size of schools, you know, kids wise, of having, you know, let's say three choices, a pre-engineered schools that you choose from that all have the same boiler systems, all have the same HVAC system, all have the same sewer system. Because what we have is we have schools built all over the place. Nothing's the same. And we don't have skilled people there to maintain these schools. So let's just say we had, here's your three choices. You pick, you know, it's already pre-engineered. It's already done. You get to choose that. Wouldn't the state save hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars if we had that choice?
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, it's an excellent question. And on the surface, it seems like it would be a fantastic idea. What you're essentially considering is a prototype school that we could roll out. Prototypes work for certain repeatable facilities, Taco Bell. They work where they roll them across the country by the hundreds. Unfortunately, since we're dealing with existing schools that don't fail at the same time, thank goodness, the prototype model does not necessarily lend itself to doing two schools this year, two schools next year, two schools in 10 years that are the same prototype for a number of reasons. Chief among those is code changes, changes to the statutes. So what works in 2 years will not work in four. What mechanical systems are available this year and next year may not be available in 4 years. So although it is a fantastic idea if we were rolling out 10, 12, 20 schools all at the same time within a couple of years, it just doesn't work as well with sort of a slow replacement model.
For the record, this is Elwin Blackwell. I just thought I would interject here through the chair, Representative Kronk. The department did actually take a look at and produced a study several years ago. I'm trying to think back. Must have been around 2016, somewhere in that neighborhood. There was a report done. We took a look at prototypical schools, prototypical systems. Some of the issues that arise within Alaska, if you're in a state that has a fairly homogeneous type of environment that you're working in, a small state, climate systems, soil systems, they're all relatively the same across the entire state. Prototypicals work fairly well. But what we have noticed in Alaska is we have such a diverse type of building environments we are in. A requirement for Southeast Alaska could be vastly different than the North Slope. And the types of building construction and the types of building techniques are so much different. Prototypical design becomes problematic or very difficult, because instead of having just two or three types of designs, you would need probably hundreds to meet, because not only do we have different building techniques, but we have multiple different types of foundation systems that these buildings would sit on. Some can be sitting on a pad. Some can be sitting on a regular poured foundation. Others have to be on pilings. There's a multiple of different types of foundation systems. One of the other issues with actually prototypical systems, as soon as you start to mandate a particular system, they become out of date. And as new technologies and new systems come in, you end up in a situation where you're constantly revising your list to try to take advantage of the new systems. I fully recognize, having spent many, many, many years in the Department of Education and interacting with our facility section over the years, I can sympathize with the fact that we get very complex systems sometimes that get installed in schools, especially out in the bush, rural Alaska, where there just are not the people with the technical skills to be able to operate and maintain them long term. I would hope that the districts would have conversations with their architects and engineers to come up with systems that may fit their need, that are not perhaps state of the art, but would still produce the types of environments they need. But I think that that's something that districts would need to talk with their design professionals when they get down to it.
And through the chair, I'll add one more thing to that. We do encourage the districts to have standardization in their systems. But again, we can't provide one system statewide that, for the reasons that he mentioned, we can't provide the same system statewide. A system that would work here would not work in Nome.
Well, thank you. Follow up. I understand that, but we do have certain areas in our state that's geographically the same. That's my question. It's like we can identify whole areas in the state where there could be 50 communities that are going to build exactly the same. So I guess that was my point. Thank you for that follow up here. Roofs, obviously, roofs are always a big item. So have we thought out of the box? I know there's a business that actually has a roof coating that, you know, lasts 20, 25 years that are for more semi-flat roofs, which a majority of our schools are pretty much semi-flat roofs. So have we looked into that? Because I see all these replacement costs after, you know, 20 years, we're putting new roofs on. Could this help alleviate millions of dollars in costs if this would work?
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, I've been in practice for nearly 30 years. I have not found a single system that is bulletproof. And I'll even bounce back a little bit from that. Buildings are perishable. And as I've stated in the past, until we figure out a way to take our buildings out of the elements, we're going to have to continue to maintain them. But every part of a building is perishable. Even the stone, if we use it, even masonry is perishable. If it's not maintained, it will eventually fail and it'll start to see its way on our list. If we don't have robust preventative maintenance, and it's up to the school system, based on the recommendation of their consultants, their architects and engineers, to provide the right type of roof system to go over and protect. But again, a roof is a perishable item. At some point, its shelf life is done and it has to be completely replaced. But we leave that to the professionals that they hire in the districts to define what type that is. Sometimes these roof systems that offer these kind of overlay solutions will not necessarily blend well to all applications. So again, I'm still looking for that magic bullet to patch a roof long term, but I've not yet found one. The only real way to do it is patch it until you can't, and then replace.
Follow up. So have we identified roofs that, let's say, are close to being replaced, and actually tried some of these systems on them to see if it would work?
The most robust roofing system that I've ever found is an EPDM product. It's essentially a rubberized material that is continuous, has no seams. It's secured to the roof. I don't want to get into too much detail here, but that is the most robust roof that has been done in the last, well, since we've been putting roofs on buildings, particularly flat roofs. Of course, a sloped roof is going to be better than a flat, but there is none, to the best of my knowledge, that exceeds the capabilities of that. And most projects these days use that system.
Thank you. One last follow-up. I'm going to refer back to Representative Stapp talking about, we know, let's just say in the BSA formula, that bigger schools have been able to take advantage of it and build bigger schools than that's needed. But the problem is maybe they don't get as much money for it, but it still costs a lot more money to maintain those schools. So even though that part is okay, what's not okay is the fact that they're coming back asking for more funds so they can maintain and heat that larger build. So thus the problem, we took advantage of this, but it still costs.
Okay. For the record, this is Owen Blackwell. Through the chair, Representative Kronk. I think I know you had a question in there, but yes, it does cost more money to maintain a larger building, and those funds would be coming out of their ostensibly their foundation funding. I mean, if they have a few other funding sources in their operating fund, but yes, the lion's share of their operating fund is covered by the foundation formula. Yeah, it would cost them more. But providing for the ability of a municipality to add square footage they don't qualify for, this was a decision that was made by the legislature back in those years. I'm assuming through some work by constituents that wanted to add more space but couldn't and get the state to participate.
Well, I have a question on page 17. I just wanted to go back and take a look at that and just talk about school bond debt reimbursement as far as the bills, HB or SB 64 from moratorium from 2015 to 2020, HB 106, 2020-2025, which we're coming to the end of that, the HB 106. Do you have a sense that there's school districts out there that that's harmed? I mean, in the sense that there's places, I guess I'll say that I know that any growing school district, and even there's, even though Anchorage may have some empty schools, they may not be in the right places and new schools need to be built. And so this might have caused them not to be able to build some schools that they need. If there was another moratorium put in, how much effect is that going to have on our, basically on our school buildings, our cap, the, you know, the actual buildings that we have out there and the ability for kids to have classrooms?
Chair Johnson, I think that the way, if this moratorium were extended, there are municipalities out there who have the capacity to go ahead and issue bonds to do school construction projects. We see Anchorage doing that even now. Every spring they come up, they have some bond projects showing up there for schools. They're self-funding those currently. There are, I know, some smaller municipalities out there with having conversations with them. If they have to foot the whole bill, they're not going to issue bonds. So in that respect, it then shoves those capital needs to either the construction or major maintenance list. So then they have to get in line for the capital grant system if this debt program isn't available. And I do know that there have been some municipalities out there who I've had conversations with in the past few years that have looked forward to the program reopening and have been holding off on debt. I can think of one instance where talking with them about the reimbursement rates, they had to stop and rethink whether or not they really wanted to issue if they were only going to get 50% participation.
I mean, 10 years is quite a long time to, I mean, that is a long time to not have that available. I mean, I can see how that works. Okay, so I think we have.
Chair, I'd like to add one more thing to that, if I
yes.
could. The debt reimbursement, as we've mentioned before, is also tied to the REAA fund. So the longer the moratorium lasts, the less money that the REAA fund will have in reserve.
Okay, very good. So we have, we'll finish up here with, we have a final questions from Representative Tomaszewski, then followed by Representative Colomb. Those will be our last couple questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, this is probably going to be a question for Acting Commissioner Teschner relating to slide number 2. And I'm very familiar with the grants and the debt reimbursement and all that, spending time in the Borough Assembly in Fairbanks and seeing those extra monies that we received last year, budget for the debt bond reimbursement. So we're very thankful for the legislature and the governor for sending those past payments through to actually have some tax relief for our property owners in the Fairbanks borough. But with the mission, the vision, and the purpose, and this is probably not something you're going to be able to answer today, but it maybe needs its own presentation. Considering out of 50, we are 49th and 50th in the states in regards to reading and mathematics. So we're at the very bottom of the of the barrel as far as reading and mathematics for our students. Our mission, an excellent education for every student every day. Our purpose, DEED exists to provide information, resources, and leadership to support an excellent education for every student every day. And the vision, all students will succeed. I know not every student is going to succeed, but when we categorically fail over years, over time, being in the bottom 49th and 50th in fundamentals as reading and mathematics, have you considered a deep dive into why those failures are occurring and what we are going to do to systematically change the system to meet these mission, vision, and purpose? And like I said, I don't expect it would be a presentation in itself. So, but have you considered that? And what are your thoughts on that? Thank you.
Yeah, for the record, Heidi Teschner, Acting Commissioner. Through the chair, it's not acceptable that we're at the bottom. I don't want us to be at the bottom. So we have systematic changes that need to happen. The READS Act is one of them. Behind which we're also doing, we're addressing math. We're in the process of developing a math strategic plan and providing extra professional development for teachers. It's a matter of having the conversations with the districts. Just one example, I will give one example. I will not name the district's name. They would like to remain confidential, but are unanimous. They went to the Science Arena Symposium last year. They made a conscious effort to come back as a team, realizing that they had purchased a curriculum. That curriculum, they never implemented it, but they decided as a team that they were going to implement it. Through implementation of it and getting the training that the teachers needed, they were able to increase their test scores, their MAP growth test scores, more than they had in 10 years. It's a matter of getting districts to stick with the program, implement it effectively, and we will see those increases with the academic increases with our students. It's going to take some time, and it's going to take some conversations with each and every district.
Thank you.
Last question there, Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure who this goes to. My question is a little more specific than Representative Tomaszewski. So I was noticing on the capital improvement project, the major maintenance grant fund list that's been approved, Abbott Loop Elementary in Anchorage is approved for fire sprinklers, and we know that Abbott Loop has been slotted to be closed. So that's a bigger question. I assume this was probably requested before that decision was made. But what follow-ups are required when they have something on the list and it's approved, and let's say the legislature gives them the money and you guys do that? Do they have to come back to you to show that they use that money for that project? In other words, what if this had gone under the radar, you guys didn't know it was canceled, and it was just left on the list, and the Anchorage School District got the money? Can they use it for any major maintenance project?
Through the chair, Representative Colon, yes, that one. There were a few things about that project made it unusual. For starters, the timing for the CIP was before they closed the school. That was one. It was also a debt project, our bond project. So they raised the capital themselves to do that project. It has not started. We are aware of it. I think there's maybe even one other school that could potentially be on our CIP list that they're talking about closing. In that case, we wouldn't fund it when they started asking for funds. We, of course, wouldn't fund that project since they're divesting of the facility. But what they do with their bond funds, I'm not sure that we have the ability to control. And then it would just go back into their general construction fund.
Through the chair, one thing else I'll add is every project that we get that actually gets funded has a project agreement. So every page of that project agreement is signed by both the district and the department, and it outlines the scope
of the hopefully what's on this project, that they don't change the scope. And then we reimburse them based on percentages of like meeting milestones. So we're constantly working with them through the life of the appropriation to make sure it's gone towards the project that it's intended for.
Okay, one follow-up. So technically, I mean, there are stages, but technically those funds could be used. I mean, you guys can't tell them that it has to be used for this project if they wanted to shift it, or they wanted to use it for a different project. They could.
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, they do provide a report to us that kind of, it's, what's it called? An annual report? Thank you. There's an annual report that they provide, and it shows all of the projects and that they spent the funds on that project.
Okay. Thank you.
Through the chair, I'd like to respond to the question. I know it was a while ago, but I'd like to respond to the question that Representative Galvin asked about the CIP list. You were talking about the length of the list, and that if we don't follow through on it, then eventually, you know, we're going to be in trouble. Of course, I'd like to ask that all projects every year be funded so we can stay ahead of the maintenance curve. At some point, if you don't do a certain percentage of projects, you fall behind even the preventive maintenance curve. And you're kiting checks at that point, where the expense of the project every year, unfortunately, buildings don't heal. They can't protect themselves from the weather. That's what their job is to do, and they also don't heal. Again, buildings are perishable. The farther you get from that expiration date, the more expensive it is and the more impact that one problem has on the rest of the facility. So when we talk about emergency projects, a lot of them become emergencies because they're neglected.
Thank you very much for your presentation today. Appreciate having you here. Thank you, Acting Commissioner Teschner, and your staff, your rather diverse multiple questions that we threw at you. Our next scheduled House Finance meeting is scheduled for Monday, March 20th, 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we will be hearing House Committee substitutes for HB 39, the operating budget, HB 79, the fast track supplemental, and HB 41, for which there are no changes to the governor's submission. We will also have public testimony on the fast track supplemental. With no further business before the committee,
just for the committee's information, when are we scheduled to get an update on the revenue forecast? Do we have that scheduled at this point?
We do not have that scheduled at this time. Take a look at the... I have not gotten... I have not gotten any information on that, but Representative Foster has comment.
Thank you.
Or Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did notice that the Senate is taking that up, I think, on the 22nd, so in a few days next week, early next week, and that's kind of a moving target of a number. We usually shoot for seeing that to be released by mid-March, so it's any day now, and so they do have that scheduled, and but I think it's a pending thing, and so I guess without knowing for sure on our side, it just wasn't scheduled at this point. But so anyway, that's what I know. Thanks.
Actually, we do have it scheduled on the 22nd.
We do?
We do, yes. So you're right on. It's not on our sheet, though.
But it is scheduled for the 22nd for us. Great. Thank you very much.
So,
good question.
With no further business now before the committee, our meeting is adjourned.